We went to the kitchen, and Grandma set the bag on the counter. "Did you knock the chair over?" she asked. "No, it was like that when we got here." I picked the fry pan up and set it on the stove. "I just went upstairs and the rooms have been searched and the keys are missing."
"We figured the bad guy snatched you," Lula said, "but now I'm thinking they took Mrs. P."
"Why would they do that?" Grandma asked.
"You weren't home," I said. "Maybe they didn't want to leave empty-handed."
"Maybe they aren't smart and they took the wrong woman," Potts said. "Maybe they thought they were taking Grandma."
"That could be it," Grandma said. "I'm real young-looking for my age. It's an easy mistake to make."
There was a slim possibility that my mom was at church or somewhere in the neighborhood. And there was a slim possibility that she'd forgotten to take her phone. And if I went with this scenario, the house got searched while she was away. I couldn't explain the overturned chair and the fry pan. I also couldn't get rid of the hollow feeling in my stomach. "Where's Dad?" I asked Grandma.
"He's fishing with Johnny Luca. They went to Belmar early this morning. I'm worried about this," Grandma said. "I don't like thinking your mother got kidnapped."
I was breathless. This was my mother, the woman who endured 22 hours of hideous labor to bring me into the world. She welcomed me home when my marriage failed. She welcomed Grandma into her home when Grandpa passed. When my sister Valerie and I turned out not to be perfect, my mother made it clear that her love wasn't dependent on perfection. She was a voice of reason. She accepted the role of practical pig because someone had to be practical pig. I know that someday there will be life without my mother, but right now, I couldn't imagine such a thing. I called Morelli and explained the situation.
"I'll put out an alert," Morelli said. "Have you contacted Ranger?"
"He's next on my list."
"Tell him to keep me in the loop."
I hung up and called Ranger. "I'm following a couple of leads," I said. "I'll be back in touch." Grandma put the potato salad in the fridge.
"There's no Entenmann's in here," she said. "And it's not on the counter or on the table. I think it got taken along with the keys."
"That's sick," Lula said. "What kind of person steals a crumb cake?"
"We have two leads," I said. "To save time, I think we should split up. I'll take Potts with me. We'll go to the Shore House in Pleasantville. Lula and Grandma, you can go to the condo in Atlantic City. Don't put yourself in jeopardy. If it looks like Shine has been using the condo, call me and I'll bring Ranger in." I dropped Lula and Grandma at Lula's car at the office, and I drove off with Potts riding shotgun.
"I have the route all mapped out on my phone," Potts said. "You take 206 to the New Jersey Turnpike."
I knew the way to Atlantic City, but I was happy to let Potts navigate if it occupied him enough to keep him from humming.
"In the movies, it only takes a few seconds for Indiana Jones to fly from the States to Istanbul," Potts said. "This road to Atlantic City feels like forever."
"Tell me about it." I was trying hard to push away horrible thoughts of my mother at the hands of Shine's thugs, but my stomach was sick and my palms were sweating on the steering wheel.
"Okay," he said. "We're coming up to the Jersey Turnpike. You want to go south?"
Good deal, I thought. I could make time on the turnpike. Going north on the turnpike from Trenton was a nightmare. Going south was usually open road. I connected with the turnpike and pushed the Buick up to 85 miles per hour. It was like driving a nuclear-powered tank with bad brakes. It was terrifying. Potts had his hands braced against the dash, and he was humming loud enough to be heard over the roar of the engine.
"Exit 11, Potts yelled. "Exit 11!
I slowed the tank and peeled off onto the Garden State Parkway. I got up to speed, and Potts was watching the exit signs fly by.
"This next one is it," he said. "The ACE is coming up at exit 38.
"The what?"
"The ACE, Atlantic City Expressway."
There was dead silence in the car for a beat.
"Holy smokes, Batman," Potts said. "It's the first clue, isn't it?"
"Yes, it wasn't ACIT. It was Atlantic City Expressway, A-C-E, initials. The Lazy Boys would have known that. I should have known that."
The next clue is 50, right? Maybe there's a Route 50.
Potts went to his phone.
Route 50 is exit 17, West Egg Harbor.
I had a choice to make. I could go to the Pleasantville house, or I could follow the clues to the treasure. I chose the Pleasantville house.
Stay on the expressway, Potts said. We want to get off on North New Road.
I hit the North New Road exit ramp and stomped on the brake. Slowing the Buick down was like slowing down a freight train. I took the easy pass lane and cruised onto North New Road.
You're going to turn left in about a half mile, Potts said.
Minutes later, we were in front of the house. It was a two-story frame that was probably built in the 50s. Very plain, but well-maintained. It was on a street with mature trees and shrubs. It had a driveway, but no garage. There were no cars parked in front of the house. A small center console boat was trailered in the driveway, no vehicle attached to the trailer.
It doesn't look like anyone's here, Potts said.
I didn't waste time with the usual sit-and-observe routine. I got out of the Buick, ran to the door, and rang the bell. No answer. I ran around to the back door and looked inside. No lights on. No one visible. The door was locked. I banged on the door. No answer. I broke the glass in the door with my gun butt and let myself in. Potts was on my heels. I did a fast search to make sure my mom wasn't in the house. I didn't find her, but I found clothes in one of the bedrooms. The clothes looked like they belonged to Shine. A couple of pinky rings had been left on the bedroom dresser. I returned to the kitchen. There was food in the fridge. The Entenmann's crumb cake box was in the trash. Plus, a crumpled wad of bloody paper towels. I froze for a moment, telling myself to breathe, to push the panic away. I had to stay calm and focused. I had to be able to think clearly. I didn't have the luxury of unproductive emotion. There was no sign of struggle in the house, no bloodstains other than the paper towels. I told myself that was a good sign, but truth is, I wasn't sure. We missed them, I said to Potts.
Maybe they know the treasure location, Potts said.
In seconds, we were in the Buick.
You need to get back on the expressway, Potts said. It's the fastest way to Route 50.
I returned to the expressway and got the Buick up to 80.
You should hum, Potts said to me.
What?
Hum. It's very calming. You look like you need calming.
He was dead on. I was having a hard time pulling myself together. What should I hum? I asked him.
Anything.
I started humming Happy Birthday. It was the only song in my head.
That's a good choice, Potts said. I hum that song a lot.
We hummed Happy Birthday together all the way to exit 17 and for a couple of minutes on Route 50.
Speed limit, Potts said. It will slow us down if we get stopped by the police or hit a cow or something.
There's a fork in the road.
Stay to the right on Route 50. Route 50 just turned into Philadelphia.
That's the third clue, Philadelphia. I thought Jimmy made this treasure hunt impossibly difficult, but he made it ridiculously easy. Benny's clue number four is pink. We traveled Route 50 through the town of Egg Harbor, looking for something pink. We left the town and drove through a residential area. Philadelphia Avenue continued on past churches, over a creek, and past a lake. From time to time, I checked my rear mirror for a rangeman car. I knew Ranger would have someone following me when they saw that I left Trenton, and he was probably coordinating with Morelli. And I suspected that Morelli was also following me. Chapter 29. I pulled to the side of the road. We must have missed it, I said. We've been on Philadelphia for a long time and there isn't anything out here. Potts went back to his phone and tapped in a satellite map of Philadelphia Avenue.
I see it, he said. There are some pink buildings about a mile up the road.
I put the Buick in gear, and in a couple of minutes we came to a driveway leading into Bowman Storage. 2 acres of single-story, pink concrete block storage units with roll-up garage doors.
This is it,
Potts whispered. I no longer wanted the treasure. I wanted my mom. I wanted her safe and unharmed. If she wasn't already here, I knew they would be bringing her here soon. I wanted to ride around and look for the black Escalade or the blue pickup, but I was driving a big, stupid, powder blue and white Buick Roadmaster. It wasn't quiet, and it never went unnoticed. I'm afraid to go any further in this car, I said to Potts. We'll be instantly recognized if Shine and his men are roaming around. I scanned the area. There weren't many places to hide a Buick. A small office with its own parking was attached to the first row of garage-sized lockers. The office looked closed and unoccupied. Two large dumpsters had been placed off to the side of the office. I drove behind the dumpsters and parked. It wasn't ideal, but it was the best I could do. The Buick would only be visible to someone depositing trash. We walked past one row of storage units and didn't see any cars. A tan Honda sedan was parked in front of the first unit on the second row. I looked past the Honda and spotted the black Escalade and a white Taurus at the other end of the building. The door was down on the unit. Two men stood beside the Escalade.
There's a car coming, Potts said.
We ducked down and wedged ourselves halfway under the Honda. A black Mercedes sedan rolled past us and parked by the other cars. Shine got out of the Mercedes. The door to the storage unit rolled up, and Shine went in. My sick stomach was back, and my heart thumped in my chest. I wondered if this happened to Indy. Probably not. He had a lot of oh crap moments, but I couldn't remember him looking nauseous. Probably because no one ever kidnapped his mother. I'm going to circle around this building so I can get close without the two men seeing me, I said to Potts.
Then what? He asked.
I don't know. One step at a time. I honestly didn't know what I would do. I had no idea what was going on inside the concrete bunker, and I didn't want to make things worse for my mom if she was in there. If I made a move to rescue her and failed, it would be horrible for both of us. I turned to go, and the garage door opened at the end of the row. Potts and I crouched behind the Honda and watched everyone come out of the storage unit. Shine stormed out first. He was waving his arms, and even from this distance I could see that his face was red.
Idiots, he yelled at the two men behind him. Fucking idiots! I can't believe you screwed this up. This was a no-brainer. Get the old lady and bring her to the locker.
We knocked on the door like you told us, one of the men said. Polite, and we asked her if she was a grandma, and she said yes.
She's not the right grandma, Shine said.
We didn't know that.
And then you brought her to the house in Pleasantville instead of the locker, Shine said.
She hit Andy with the frying pan and he had a big gash on his cheek, so we stopped at the house for a Band-Aid. We figured there wouldn't be any Band-Aids here.
Now she knows about the house, Shine said.
She wasn't in the house, the guy said. She was in the trunk. I figure it doesn't matter because we're gonna kill her anyway.
We still need the old lady, Shine said. The right grandma. She has the last clue. She has the numbers to get into the safe.
Two more men walked out of the storage locker, bookending my mother. Her hands were bound. Her walk was steady and unassisted. She looked okay.
Follow me to the safe house, Shine said. We'll stick her there and use her to get the old lady.
Shine got into the Mercedes. My mom was placed in the back seat of the Escalade with the two men. One of the men standing watch on the outside of the unit got behind the wheel. The fourth man shut the garage door and got into the Taurus.
They've got your mom and they're leaving, Potts said.
We need to get to the Buick.
Indy would take this car,
Potts said. This Honda?
The owner is in the storage unit behind us, Potts said. I can hear him rummaging around in there, and he left his car unlocked with the key fob in the cup holder.
That's car theft. The three cars drove single file around the end of the building, with the Mercedes leading the way.
They won't know it's us in this car, Potts said. And it's here.
He opened the door, got behind the wheel, and started the car. I ran around the car and jumped in.
This is a nice car, Potts said, rounding the end of the row. The owner keeps it clean inside. It smells nice. After I got the job delivering pizza, my car always smelled like pizza.
I've never seen your car.
I traded it for a PlayStation 4 Pro.
You traded a car for a gaming console?
It wasn't much of a car, and the 4 Pro is awesome.
Shine turned right onto Philadelphia, and the two cars followed him. We gave them a good lead before we exited the storage facility. I called Lula. It's not necessary for you to look at the condo, I said. Go to Egg Harbor and wait for me to get back to you.
Did you find your mom? She asked.
Yes, but it's complicated. I can't talk now. Just wait in Egg Harbor. An occasional bungalow hugged the side of the road, but mostly we were driving through scrubby pine, intermingled with heavier forested areas. After 2 miles, the Mercedes led the other two cars onto a gravel driveway and disappeared into the woods. Potts pulled to the side of the road and cut the engine. I slid the window down and listened. Car doors slamming shut. Men talking. And then quiet.
This is where we abandon the car, Potts said.
I get the feeling you've done this before.
Mostly in video games. Usually there's a high-speed chase involved. I'm awesome at the high-speed chase, especially if it's an obstacle course.
We walked the length of the driveway and moved into the woods to look at the house. It was a small ranch, probably 3 bedrooms. The yellow paint was peeling, and the yard was mostly dirt and weeds. No garage. Everyone was inside.
Now what? Potts asked.
Everyone is inside and the shades are down. That means they can't see out. I'm going to the back of the house and try to determine where they're keeping my mom. I'm guessing they'll stash her in a bedroom. I sent Morelli's and Ranger's phone numbers to Potts's cell phone. You stay here and call Joe Morelli and Ranger. Fill them in and give them our location. I slipped my phone into my back pocket and tucked my .38 into the waistband of my jeans. I left my messenger bag with Potts and instructed him to guard it with his life. New mantra, I told myself. From here on out, it was balls to the wall. I moved across the yard with as much stealth as possible. I hugged the side of the house and listened at a living room window. I could hear men talking. I couldn't make out what they were saying. I had a half-inch view of the room where the shade didn't meet the window frame. I knew there had been 5 men in the cars. I could see 3 of them in the room. I didn't see my mom, and I didn't hear her voice. A 4th man crossed the room and disappeared from view. I crept around to the back and peeked in a kitchen window. No one there. I got lucky at the far end of the house. I found a bedroom window with the shade half closed, and I could see my mom duct-taped to a straight-back chair. I caught her attention and made a sign not to talk. I tried opening the window. Locked. Breaking the window could draw the attention of the men in the living room, but I saw no other option. I didn't want a SWAT team arriving and my mom inside as a bargaining chip. I was about to smash the glass with my gun butt when Gabriella tapped me on the shoulder and scared the bejesus out of me. I would have instinctively shot her, but I was holding the wrong end of my gun. I'm here to help, she whispered. How did you get here?
I followed you, of course.
She held up a glass-cutting tool. Do you always carry a glass-cutting tool?
Tools of the trade, she said, fixing a suction cup to the window.
What trade is that? I asked.
It depends on the moment, Gabriella said. By my count, there are 5 men in the house. Another car with 2 more men just arrived, and the men are standing watch outside. We're going to take your mom out the window, cross the backyard, and go straight into the woods. I'll cover you.
My mom's eyes were as big as saucers. I gave her a thumbs up, and she did an eye roll so huge that it almost tipped her chair over. 30 seconds later, Gabriella removed a circle of glass from the window, reached in,
and opened the lock. The window was up, and Gabriella crawled in. She cut my mom free and passed her out of the window to me. Gabriella followed.
"Is your grandmother okay?"
my mom asked me.
"Yes," I said. "She's with Lula."
"She won't be okay when I get done with her," my mom said. "I'm going to put her in assisted living somewhere far away, Georgia or Texas or Slovakia. I told her to give the keys to Benny, and she wouldn't do it, and you're no better. You went along with it all, and look what happened. I got kidnapped. They put me in the trunk of a car."
"I know. I'm sorry, but we need to discuss this later."
"In the trunk of a car."
"Not now, Mom. We need to get out of here."
I grabbed her arm and pulled her toward the tree line. We were halfway across the hard scrabble yard when one of the men walked around the side of the house. He shouted to his partner and fired a shot over our heads. Gabriella turned and fired two shots, hitting the gunman on the second. He went down to the ground, and we ran into the woods. Gabriella caught up to us and turned us in another direction.
"We want to circle around the house and go toward the road," she said. "Slow down and try not to make noise. There's a rusted-out Airstream camper just past the house. We can use it for cover, and I can try to pick them off one by one."
We bushwhacked through the undergrowth, listening to the men shouting to each other back at the house and in the woods behind us. Gabriella was leading the way. She looked like she knew what she was doing, and she was dressed for the job. Camo cargo pants, a form-fitting V-neck olive drab t-shirt, and thick-soled spike-studded boots, small camo backpack, olive drab utility gun belt sized for a woman. Gabriella held her hand up, and we all stopped and listened. Someone was stalking us. Dried leaves and twigs were crackling under his footstep. I could see a sliver of silver peeking out of the thick vegetation in front of us. It was the Airstream. Gabriella motioned for us to go. We covered half the distance to the camper, and a man burst out of the woods in front of us, holding us at gunpoint. Without a moment of hesitation, I pulled a POTS. I staggered sideways a little, rolled my eyes back in my head, and did an Academy Award-winning feint, grabbing hold of my mom and pulling her down with me. The instant we hit the ground, Gabriella went airborne, looking like G.I. Ninja. She planted her boot to the man's chest. He let out a whoosh of air, and the gun dropped out of his hand. Gabriella kicked him hard in the crotch with her toe spikes. He went to his knees and rolled into a fetal position.
"He was the one who locked me in the trunk," my mom said, getting to her feet.
"Asshole," she yelled at the guy, and she kicked him in the vicinity of a kidney. Another thug came out of the woods and went for Gabriella. I rushed over and yelled, "Hey!" He turned to look at me, and I smashed him in the face with my gun butt. Blood gushed out of his nose, and I hit him again.
"Ow," Gabriella said. "Nicely done."
A police chopper flew low over the yellow ranch house. Red and blue lights flashed on the driveway. We could see parts of the house through the trees. It was surrounded by men in black SWAT gear. I recognized them as range men. We walked out of the woods, and by the time we reached the house, the yard was filled with cars. Local cop cars, rangeman SUVs, and two EMTs. The last car down the driveway was Lula with Potts and Grandma. Lula, Grandma, and Potts parked and hurried over to us. Grandma grabbed my mom and hugged her close.
"Are you okay?" she asked. "Are you okay?"
"I don't know," my mom said.
"I think so. I was really scared. They locked me in the trunk of a car, and they put duct tape across my mouth."
"They did that to me, too," Potts said. "It was uncomfortable. I don't want to have that happen anymore."
My mom turned to me.
"Thank you for rescuing me, but you could have been killed. I saw your face in the window, and I had such a mix of emotions. Relief that I might be able to escape, and horror that you might be captured, or worse. Those men were terrible. No respect for anything. And then Charlie Shine showed up. I never liked him. All those gaudy pinky rings, and everyone knew he abused women."
"It looks like we missed all the good stuff," Lula said. "And I see Gabriella standing over there all by herself. What's she doing here?"
"She followed me," I said. "And she helped with the rescue.
She shot someone, my mom said to Lula. And she flew through the air and wiped out one of the bad guys like you see on television. And then Stephanie smashed her gun into another bad guy's face.
And you kicked one of them, I said. It was a good kick, too, right in the kidney.
I got carried away, my mom said. She looked around. There are a lot of people here.
I called Joe Morelli and Ranger, Potts said. They were already on their way. Ranger was right behind us. I think Morelli must have notified the local police.
He looked at me.
Lula and your grandma were waiting in Egg Harbor, and I told them to come here. I hope that was okay.
He had my messenger bag hung crossbody. I took the bag from him and told him he did great.
It's like I'm in a video game, he said, grinning. Freaking awesome, now that it's over.
Ranger walked over, raised the flap on my messenger bag, and dropped the two safe keys into the bag.
I found these on Shine when we went inside ahead of the police. Don't let them get away from you. I need to send some of my men back to Trenton. I'll catch up with you later.
A police transport truck and a third ambulance parked in the front yard. Morelli drove in and went to the transport truck. He turned midway, stopped, and looked at me for a long moment. I gave him a thumbs up, he nodded acknowledgement, and continued on to the truck.
It's almost here, Grandma said. Treasure time. We just need to go get it.
Chapter 30. It was close to 4 o'clock when we assembled at the storage facility. Grandma, Lula, Potts, my mom, Morelli, Ranger, and Ramon, Ranger's safe-cracking specialist. Gabriella was there as well, keeping to herself. Ranger unlocked the door to the storage unit, rolled the door up, and we all peeked inside. The unit was the size of a single-car garage. It was concrete block on the inside, just like it was concrete block on the outside. It was lit by two fluorescent ceiling fixtures. The unit contained a brown leather, slightly used Lazy Boy recliner and a large safe. The garage door was the only exit. Ramon stepped forward with a backpack.
I know this style safe, he said. This should not be a problem.
Did you tell him about Hiroshima? I asked Ranger.
Yes, Ranger said. He knows about Hiroshima.
I gave the two keys and the two wedding bands to Ramon. He walked to the safe and set his backpack on the floor. Everyone moved away from the unit. How long will this take? I asked Ranger.
Not long, he said. One way or the other.
Do you think we're far enough away? Lula asked. Hiroshima is big.
Potts moved behind Lula as if that would protect him from nuclear disaster. Morelli wasn't saying anything. He was looking on with his cop face in place. Gabriella was silent. Grandma was leaning forward in anticipation, her eyes focused like lasers on the safe. I was a half step behind Grandma. We'd been through a lot to reach this point, and now that the nightmare of worrying about everyone's safety was over, I was getting excited about the treasure. My excitement had less to do with how I was going to spend it as what exactly was this treasure. Bars of gold? A priceless relic? What had we been chasing? The minutes ticked on. It seemed like a lifetime, but it was only 4 minutes on my watch when Ramon finally stepped away from the safe. The door was open, and there was a collective sigh of relief that we hadn't all been blown to bits. We rushed into the storage unit and stared at the inside of the safe. It was as if all of the air had been sucked out of the room. And no one moved. Everyone was frozen in stunned silence.
It's empty, Grandma finally said. There's nothing in it but some comic books. It looks to me like Jimmy used to come here to sit in his Lazy Boy and read comics. How could this be? Where's the treasure?
Superman and Uncle Scrooge, Potts said. Excellent choice of comics, but not worth much in their present condition.
This here's a bummer, Lula said. I almost got blown up for nothing.
There was no charge attached to it, Ramon said. There was no chance of Hiroshima.
Lula was hands on hips.
Well, what about those tunnels with the rats and the fire and the crazy-ass old assassin? What about that?
All in a day's work, I said. Morelli was standing next to me. He looked over at me, quizzical. I shrugged. Truth is, it could have turned out a lot worse. My mother and my grandmother could have been horribly hurt or killed. I could have been horribly hurt or killed. Those possibilities had been laid to rest.
The lazy boys were sure there was a treasure in here. There were clues. There were keys, Grandma said. They were willing to kidnap and kill for it. What happened to it?
In this video game I play, there's a princess, and a dragon took her treasure. It was in a chest in the tower room, and the dragon flew away with it,
Potts said.
I like it, Lula said. Some hotshot dragon flew away with the princess's treasure. I guess it could happen, Grandma said. Did the princess get her treasure back?
I'm working on it, Potts said.
I can't think about this anymore, my mom said. I'm exhausted. Look at the time. I need to get dinner going.
I need some selfies for Facebook and Instagram, Grandma said, standing in front of the safe. I bet I could be a sensation. And if nobody minds, I'm going to take the comic books. I'm going to snap some selfies, too, Lula said. I might be able to add in a dragon to mine.
Gabriella hadn't moved forward with everyone else. She'd stood in place. Her expression throughout was thoughtful. Ranger was back on his heels with the same thoughtful expression. I knew what they were thinking, because I was thinking the same thing. This wasn't done. There was more. Morelli's phone buzzed, and he checked the screen.
I have to go, he said to me. I don't want to lose sight of Shine, and I have paperwork to do. I'll call you later.
I turned to Lula when Morelli walked away. Can you take everyone home? I want to stay and talk to Ranger and Gabriella.
No problem, Lula said. I might even let Potts hum. He told me he stole a car so you could sneak up on the bad guys. He's coming along.
I waved them off, and I walked back to the safe. Ranger and Gabriella joined me. What was supposed to be in here? I asked Gabriella.
Diamonds, she said. D-color and flawless. I represent the legal owner of the diamonds, and I've been empowered to claim them and have them tested and ultimately returned to my employer.
I assume you have documentation for this, I said to Gabriella.
I do, she said. Morelli has seen it, and it's been filed with the court in the appropriate agencies.
Why were you following me? I asked her. Why didn't you just go after the diamonds?
You and I have something in common, Gabriella said. Tenacity. Beyond that, our talents are miles apart. You have no skills whatsoever, but you have dumb luck and uncanny instinct. I have skills, but I don't always have luck. And as they say, it's better to be lucky than good, at least some of the time. I realized in this instance I was better advised to follow you around and let you find the diamonds than for me to do my own investigation. All I had to do was keep you alive. That in itself is a full-time job.
I shifted my attention to Ranger. Did you know?
No, he said. I was concentrating on keeping you in cars.
None of the lazy boys took the diamonds, I said. I'm sure Jimmy has them stashed somewhere, either for himself or as part of the clue system. Shine had the last clue, number 9. That was the number on the storage locker. The wedding bands had the safe combination, but maybe that wasn't Jimmy's clue.
You know the location of the clue, Gabriella said.
I nodded. I have a suspicion. Look under the lazy boy seat cushion. Ranger lifted the cushion and found a folded piece of paper and a key ring with some age-worn keys on it. Ranger pocketed the keys on the key ring and opened the paper.
R.I.P. Anthony.
I called Connie. Did Jimmy Rizzoli have a relative named Anthony?
His grandfather, Connie said. Anthony Rizzoli. Do you know where he's buried? Hold on, Connie said. I'll ask my mom.
Connie came back on the line a minute later.
She thinks it's St. John's. It's outside of Egg Harbor. Anthony was a big deal. He immigrated from Sicily and he was made. I guess he was like godfather or something. Mom said she was a little girl when she visited the cemetery, but she remembers that Anthony Rizzoli had a house there.
A house in the cemetery?
She said it was probably a little chapel or maybe a monument, but she remembers it as a house. I already heard there was no treasure. Sorry about that.
It's okay, I said. Life goes on. I hung up and looked at Ranger and Gabriella.
St. John's Cemetery.
Let's check it out, Ranger said. Ramon has already gone back to Trenton, but I have the keys and the wedding bands.
Gabriella had the cemetery pulled up on her smartphone.
It's about 20 minutes from here. Follow me.
St. John's Cemetery was on the northwest side of Egg Harbor. It was a small, ancient-looking graveyard attached to a small, ancient-looking Catholic church. We parked on a dirt road that ran parallel to the church lot, crossed over some scrub vegetation, and passed through the elaborate wrought iron gate that led to the graves. We read the names on the weathered tombstones as we walked. Giancini, Mancuso, Salerno, Capaletti. Obelisks, crosses, statues of the Virgin marked the graves of the wealthy. Others had simple granite markers. A badly maintained small stone and granite chapel had been erected on a patch of flat ground in the middle of the cemetery. There was a peaked roof on the one-story windowless building and two Corinthian-style columns on either side of the door. The entire building was decorated with reliefs of angels, cherubs, Madonnas, and horse-drawn chariots. The name carved into granite above the door was Rizzoli.
I think we found the house of Rizzoli, I said.
Ranger tried the door. Locked. He looked at the three keys on the key ring he found in the lazy boy chair and selected one. He turned the key in the lock, and the door opened. He switched the light on, and nothing happened. No electricity. We stepped inside, and Ranger and Gabriella powered up their mag lights. The walls were covered with religious paintings. Some were in the form of murals, others were on velvet. An occasional cobweb clung to the velvet. Two rows of ornately carved pews that could have seated no more than four people were on either side of a center aisle. A small altar holding a cross and a bunch of burned-out votives was at the front of the room. There was a tiny cast-iron staircase behind the altar. I saw Ranger scan the room, looking for security cameras. See anything? I asked him.
No, he said. I think this chapel no longer plays an important role in the spiritual life of the Rizzoli family.
We followed Gabriella to the staircase and descended single file to the underground room.
A crypt, Gabriella said.
There were 12 niches in the room, 6 on each side. The walls, ceiling, and floor were concrete. Hammered copper doors sealed each of the niches. Names of the interred were on the doors. Sarah Rizzoli, Salvatore Rizzoli, Manfred Rizzoli, Joseph Rizzoli, Anthony Rizzoli. Gabriella stood in front of Anthony Rizzoli.
Hello, Anthony, she said.
Ranger looked at Gabriella's camo backpack.
Do you have anything useful in there?
He asked her. Gabriella removed a screwdriver and handed it to Ranger. Ranger pried the copper door off the wall and exposed the casket.
Usually there's a second shutter here, he said. The copper shutter I just removed is decorative. There should be a heavier metal shutter that actually seals the tomb.
Pull him out, Gabriella said. There's a reason he wasn't sealed in. Ranger slid a mahogany casket out of the niche, and Gabriella and I helped lower it to the floor. Ranger slipped the brass latch on the lid and raised the lid.
It's not locked and it's not sealed, he said. And it's empty.
Gabriella and I looked inside.
The satin lining wasn't in great shape, but the casket had obviously never been used, or maybe only used for a short time. "Where's Anthony?" I asked.
"Probably bunking with someone," Ranger said. "Probably with Mrs. Rizzoli."
Ranger flicked the beam of his flashlight into the niche.
"Looks like the niche opens to a tunnel."
I did a mental head slap. What's with these guys and their tunnels? It's like they had a tunnel obsession.
"Escape routes," Ranger said.
"Places to hide stolen treasures and bootleg whiskey," Gabriella said, flashing the maglite beam around the space, crawling into the niche.
"I came across something similar in Nepal when I was hired to find a stolen carving of Virupaksha from the Pashupatinath Temple in Kathmandu. I thought for sure it was in that tunnel. Turned out it was filled with vipers. Let's hope this goes better. Truly, what are the chances of that happening twice?"
Considering my recent tunnel experiences, I thought the odds weren't in my favor. I followed Gabriella into the niche, and Ranger followed me. The tunnel was dirt and supported by chunky, crude timbers. It was a couple of feet wide and not quite 6 feet high. Ranger had to duck slightly when standing. After about 50 feet, we came to a Y intersection. "Go to the right," I said.
"Intuition?" Gabriella asked.
"There's a symbol burned onto the timber. I've seen it in the Lazy Boys tunnels. Potts was the first to notice it. I have pictures." We turned toward the symbol and came to another fork. Again, a symbol told us to go right. The right-hand tunnel curved, and we came to a heavy metal fire door. Ranger selected a second key on the key ring and opened the door to a small concrete room with a safe embedded in the concrete. A second metal fire door was on the far wall.
"Interesting," Gabriella said. "This takes mob paranoia to a new level."
Ranger opened the door with the third key on the ring. Beyond the door was a short dirt tunnel that ended with a ladder going to a manhole cover. This was almost identical to the escape hatch opening to Liberty Park. Ranger climbed the ladder and put his hand to the heavy cover.
"If it's like the Liberty Park cover, it has two steel pins that need to be pulled out," Gabriella said.
Ranger felt around, found the pins, pulled them out, and moved the cover to the side.
"What do you see?" I asked. "A field," Ranger said. "A road in the distance. The cemetery and church in the opposite direction."
He dropped to the floor and walked to the safe.
"This looks familiar," he said.
"Looks identical," Gabriella said.
"The only difference is that this safe is set into the concrete wall."
I was excited at the thought of opening the safe in the storage locker. I was filled with dread over the opening of this safe. "I have a bad feeling," I said. "I think we should get Ramon."
"It's your treasure," Ranger said to Gabriella. "What's your call?"
"I'm willing to roll the dice," Gabriella said. "Give me Grandma's keys and the wedding rings. I was watching Ramon. He started with the numbers on Grandma's ring."
"I'm not so sure," I said. "He had both rings in his hand, and we were standing at a distance, and he was using some gizmo to help him hear the tumblers. If you start with the wrong number, you'll blow us up."
"I can feel the tumblers on this without a gizmo," Gabriella said. "The only thing unusual about this safe is that it has two keys instead of one. The rest is basic. I opened a number of safes just like this in Portugal when I was looking for some stolen Patek Philippe watches."
"Did you find them?" I asked.
"Yes, but not in those safes. Those safes were filled with drugs, compromising pictures, and one had an entire Iberian ham leg."
"Must have been a big safe," I said.
"Average," Gabriella said. "It was a relatively small pig."
Ranger gave her the keys and the rings, and I backed away toward the ladder. "I might need some fresh air," I said. Gabriella inserted the keys.
"They fit," she said.
Ranger was behind her, focused.
"Grandma's sequence starts with the number 2, Gabriella said.
She carefully turned the dial to the number 2.
"Oops," Gabriella said when it didn't tumble. "Shit."
Ranger yanked her away from the safe and shoved her through the open doorway. He jumped into the tunnel after her and slammed the fire door shut. I was already halfway up the ladder. Gabriella and Ranger were close behind me. Bang! The first explosion blew the fire door off just as we bolted out of the manhole. The ground shook, throwing me off balance, knocking me to my knees. Ranger jerked me to my feet, and we ran across the field until the second explosion sent us to the ground. The second explosion shot fire out of the manhole and blew a crater in the roof of the concrete bunker. Chunks of sod and concrete shot into the air and plummeted to the earth. Scraps of blue velvet floated down, and diamonds glinted in the sunlight like it was raining fairy dust. The ground rolled and rumbled, and a third explosion blasted the Rizzoli Chapel into nothing more than a memory.
"Hiroshima," I said.
Gabriella nodded.
"My bad. I shouldn't have taken the risk."
The first responders all went to the smoking rubble of the chapel. That left us to pick diamonds out of the scrub grass in the field.
"How many were there?"
I asked Gabriella.
174 lovingly stored in 4 blue velvet cases.
Oh boy.
After an hour, we had collected 87, and we had attracted the attention of a couple of the men at the chapel site.
"Time to go," Ranger said. "Gabriella can continue to search for the diamonds later today or tomorrow."
We crossed the field, picking up a few more diamonds on the way. We reached our cars, and Gabriella tossed her backpack onto the Mercedes passenger side seat.
"Good luck with the diamonds," I said to her.
"It's been interesting."
"All in a day's work," she said.
Ranger drove into my apartment building's lot and parked next to Grandma Mazur's Buick.
"You didn't destroy any cars today," Ranger said, "but you blew up a chapel, so your day wasn't a complete bust."
"Technically, Gabriella blew up the chapel."
"She chose poorly," Ranger said.
"It's amazing that she was able to retrieve so many diamonds. I don't imagine she'll find all of them."
"I can guarantee it," Ranger said, taking my hand and placing a diamond in it. "I thought you deserved the finder's fee. You might not ever be able to cash this in, but you can put it in your underwear drawer with all your other treasures."
"I don't have any other treasures."
"Not yet," Ranger said.
Chapter 31 Morelli knocked on my door at 9 o'clock. He had a bottle of wine and a box of cupcakes.
"Is this a celebration?" I asked him.
"I thought we'd see how it goes."
He opened the bottle, and we took the wine and cupcakes into the living room.
"This has been a busy day for you," I said. "I heard Shine took a plea bargain on the kidnapping."
"We brought him in, and he went off on a rant. His lawyer was sitting next to him, and he couldn't stop Shine from talking."
"Anything you can share with me?"
"I'm going to share everything with you. It's going to all come out anyway. You can't keep a secret in the burg. 18 years ago, a guy named Polly Valenti was working as a tech for a security company. On one of his jobs, he got to see the interior of a vault in a pricey Manhattan brownstone. The vault held racks of gemstones, mostly diamonds. Polly mentions this to his cousin, who mentions it to his wife, who mentions it to Jimmy's wife, who mentions it to Jimmy, who tells the Lazy Boys. The Lazy Boys get friendly with Polly, and before Polly knows it, he's deep in their pocket and providing them with security codes to all his accounts. 2 weeks later, the Lazy Boys, armed with safe-cracking tools and the security code, break into the Manhattan brownstone and make off with $30 million worth of diamonds. They grab 4 boxes indiscriminately, choosing them by their unique blue velvet cases. It turns out the diamonds weren't the largest or most valuable. They were the owner's private collection. They were the diamonds that were never supposed to be sold. The owner goes gonzo and offers a $60 million reward for the capture of the thieves and the return of the diamonds. This is double the value of the diamonds.
He took it personally.
Big time.
Let me guess the fate of Polly, I said.
We did some digging in old police reports, and Polly's fate wasn't good. A shallow grave in Far Rockaway.
So they took the diamonds and hid them away until they weren't so hot?
Yes, but it's more than that. All diamonds are unique. They have their own distinct fingerprint that identifies them under X-ray or with the use of a laser. The owner distributed the fingerprints of his diamonds to every law enforcement agency, every jeweler, every pawn shop, every black market fence worldwide. The lazy boys had no choice but to hide them away for a long time.
If they're all perfectly hidden away, how did Gabriella track them to Trenton?
One of the smaller diamonds surfaced. Jimmy brought it to a trader in New York's Diamond District. Jimmy told him it was his wife's, but his wife had passed some time ago, and now he was going to get married, and he needed money for his honeymoon.
Oh, my God. Morelli was grinning.
I know. It gets better and better. Anyway, the trader lasered the diamond and checked the list and knew it was hot. He bought it from Jimmy because he knew the reward was a lot more than the money he shelled out for the stone. Unfortunately for the trader, he walked into a bullet when he was closing up shop that night. I feel comfortable assuming Jimmy was the shooter. Unfortunately for the lazy boys, the trader had already sent an email to the diamond's legal owner. And the owner hired Gabriella to retrieve the diamonds. My understanding is that Gabriella is an expert at treasure retrieval.
Did Shine say anything about how he found the safe location?
He followed Jimmy way back when Jimmy first hid the treasure. Shine always knew where the safe was located, but he didn't know how to get in without setting off the explosion.
As it turns out, the treasure wasn't in the safe anyway, I said. Morelli topped off our wine.
You were surprisingly mellow when the safe turned out to be empty.
In the end, it was the journey and not the destination for me. I am upset that you knew about Gabriella and didn't tell me.
I couldn't.
One of those cop things.
Yes.
Morelli cut his eyes to the cupcake box.
Are you going to eat the chocolate one with the sprinkles?
I might have been thinking about it.
What would it take to bargain it away from you?
What have you got to offer? Morelli smiled.
Something a lot better than a cupcake.
I knew this to be true. Gabriella Rose returns in Janet Ivanovich's next novel, coming in July 2021. Here's a sneak peek. Gabriella Rose was standing in a small clearing that led to a rope and board footbridge, which was swaying in the wind. The narrow bridge spanned a gorge that was 100 feet deep and almost as wide. Rapids rushed over enormous boulders at the bottom of the gorge, but Gabriella couldn't see the water, because it was raining buckets and she could barely make out the far side. She was celebrating her 30th birthday deep in the Ecuadorian rainforest. The birthday wasn't important to her. She was all about the job. Her long dark brown hair was hidden under her Australian safari hat, its brim shading her exotic almond-shaped brown eyes. She was 5'6" and slim. She kept in shape for the job, but also because she liked pretty clothes. And pretty clothes didn't always come in size 14. She was with two local guides, Jorge and Cuckoo. She guessed they were somewhere between 40 and 60 years old, and she was pretty sure that they thought she was an idiot. "Is this bridge safe?" Gabriella asked. "Yes, sometimes safe," Jorge said. "And it's the only way?" Jorge shrugged. She looked at Cuckoo. Cuckoo shrugged. "You first," she said to Jorge. Jorge did another shrug and murmured something in Spanish that Gabriella was pretty sure translated to chicken shit woman. Let it slide, Gabriella thought. Sometimes it gave you an advantage to be underestimated. If things turned ugly, she was almost certain she could kick his ass. And if that didn't work out, she could shoot him. Nothing fatal. Maybe take off a toe. It had been raining when she landed in Quito 2 days ago. It was still raining when she took the 25-minute flight to Coca and boarded a Napo River ferry to Nuevo Rocafuerte. and it was raining when she met her guides at daybreak and settled into their motorized canoe for the 6-hour trip down a narrow, winding river with no name. Just before noon, they'd pulled up at a crude campground hacked out of the jungle. 4 hours on foot after that, following a trail that barely existed. All in the pouring rain. She'd been hired to find Henry Dodge and retrieve a ring he was carrying. Not a lot of information on the ring or Dodge, just that he couldn't leave his job site and he'd requested that someone come to get the ring. Seemed reasonable, since Dodge was an archaeologist doing research on a lost civilization in a previously unexplored part of the Amazon rainforest. The payoff for Gabriella was a big bag of money, but that wasn't what convinced her to take the job. She was a treasure hunter, for profit and for pleasure. She was an amateur anthropologist, a descendant of Blackbeard, a history buff, and a collector of pirate plunder. The opportunity to visit a lost city site was irresistible. "How much further?" she asked Jorge. "Not far," he said. "Just on the other side of the bridge." 10 minutes later, Gabriella set foot on the dig site. She'd been on other digs, and this wasn't what she'd expected. There was some partially exposed rubble that might have been a wall at one time, a couple of tables with benches under a tarp, a kitchen area that was also under a tarp, a stack of wooden crates, a trampled area that suggested several tents had been recently used and recently abandoned. Only one small tent was left standing. There were no people to see except for one waterlogged and slightly bloated dead man lying on the ground by the rubble and a weary-looking man sitting nearby on a camp chair.
"This is not good," Jorge said. "One of these men is very dead and something has eaten his leg."
"Panther," the man in the chair said. "You can hear them prowling past your tent at night. This site is a hellhole. Were you folks just out for a stroll in the rain?"
"I was sent to get a ring from Henry Dodge," Gabriella said. "I believe I was expected." The man nodded to the corpse.
"That's Henry. Had some bad luck."
"What happened?"
"He was checking on an excavation in the rain first thing this morning, fell off the wall and smashed his head on the rocks. Then a panther came and ate his leg before we could scare it away. Everyone packed up and left after that. Too many bad things happening here."
"But you stayed," Gabriella said.
"They couldn't carry everything out in one trip. I stayed with some of the remaining crates and the body. Cameron said he would be back with help before it got dark."
"Do you know where Henry kept the ring?" Gabriella asked.
"It's on his finger," the man said. "He felt it was the safest place."
Gabriella looked at the dead man's hand. It was grotesquely swollen and clenched in a fist. The ring was barely visible.
"Someone needs to get the ring off his finger," Gabriella said.
No one volunteered. Gabriella flicked a centipede off her sleeve. Could the day get any worse? She was wet, clear through to her La Perla panties. Her boots and camo cargo pants were covered with mud, and she had bug bites everywhere.
"All part of the jungle experience," she told herself.
The dead man with the swollen hand was not. The question now was, how bad did she want the ring? The lost city site had turned out to be a bust, but there was still a payday attached to the ring. So the answer to the question was that she wanted the ring pretty damn bad. Without the ring, there would be no big bag of money, and she needed the money to finance her own treasure hunt. She'd recently found a 300-year-old map that had been lost in her family for 15 generations. It was a treasure map signed by Blackbeard, and she had it on good authority that it was real.
"I've come this far," she said. "I'm not going back without the ring."
She looked at the man in the chair.
"I need to pry Dodge's hand open and work the ring off his finger. I need gloves and a baggie. I know all archaeological sites have them."
The man shrugged his shoulders as an apology.
"They were all packed out. Truth is, we were shutting down before Henry happened. Henry was a holdout. He found the ring, and he thought there was more here. The rest of us didn't care.
We need to leave now, Jorge said. It will be bad to be in this jungle after sunset. Hard to find the way, and panthers will be hunting at night. We have maybe 5 hours of daylight left.
I'm not leaving without the ring, Gabriella said.
Cuckoo took his machete out of its sheath, and whack! He chopped Henry Dodge's hand off at the wrist.
I suppose that's one way to go, Gabriella said. I would have preferred to try my way first.
He's dead, Cuckoo said. He doesn't need the hand.
He picked the hand up by the thumb, grabbed Gabriella's day pack, and dropped the hand in.
Problem is solved, Jorge said.
Fortune and Glory, a Stephanie Plum novel, book 27, was written by Janet Ivanovich and read by Lorelei King. It was recorded by Gareth Wood at the Sound Company Studio in London, England. Editing, mix, and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. Fortune and Glory was produced and directed by Randy Dolnick. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Fortune and Glory, a Stephanie Plum novel, book 27, is available in print from Atria Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.